This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. You found us. Truth seekers, come on in, rest a spell, warm yourself by the fire. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. And when I was lining up tonight's broadcast, I wasn't even aware that next week, at least up here north of the 49th, next week is officially Emergency Preparedness Week. And once again, The Conspiracy Show is ahead of the curve because we're going to talk about the possibility of a natural or even man-made calamity heading our way. Michael Maloof will join us momentarily to talk about the possibility of an imminent and major EMP event. EMP, what is EMP? Electromagnetic pulse event, which, as you'll learn shortly, would have catastrophic consequences on all of us who reside here in the New World, North America. So in advance of Emergency Preparedness Week, we'll talk about emergency preparedness, because if we wait until Emergency Preparedness Week, it could be too late. The black ops and the rogue elements always stage false flag operations during such times. Have you noticed? Remember the assassination attempt on Dutch Reagan? It was staged during a continuity of governance drill. And the London bombings, there was a drill going on in the tube at the time. Boston Marathon, there were rumblings that there was an anti-terror drill going on. So there you go. Listen, I'm not suggesting anything here, but before we get Michael Maloof in here, I wanted to bring this to your attention as well. Residents here in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, were all on social media earlier this evening after reportedly hearing a loud bang and seeing a flaming object streak across the sky. Did you see it? Did you hear it? Someone in Oakville reported seeing the object around 4:15 p.m. this afternoon. And there were others who spotted it up in Newmarket and even as far east as Whitby. Peterborough police have received a number of calls describing some type of explosion and houses shaking in the aftermath. And even the American Meteor Society has listed 22 reports ranging from New York, New Jersey, St. Catharines, and Caledon. They're all talking about a fireball in the sky. No official word on what the item was or when and where it may have touched down. But it's interesting to note that the annual Eta Aquarids meteor shower is actually expected to peak this week. But there's no official word whether what was seen and heard is part of that annual shower. And the meteors seen in the Eta Aquarids shower are apparently, I didn't know this, they're pieces of Halley's Comet that separated about 100 years ago, or hundreds of years ago. Now, a meteor shower is really a thing to behold. It's a thing of beauty. But we also need to be aware that sometimes death and destruction can rain down from the heavens. And one of the greatest threats staring us in the face right now is one that's not getting the attention it deserves. And I'm talking about the threat of a major electromagnetic pulse event, a major EMP, would essentially fry every piece of electronics in its path, including the electrical grid. Were such an EMP event to occur, think about it. I mean, we would be thrown back to horse and buggy days in a matter of moments. And the lights would be out for a very extended period of time. We're not talking just 72 hours. That's what they're during Emergency Preparedness Week. You'll see all of these PSAs and you'll see the posters. You need to prepare for 72 hours. Have enough fresh water and food, batteries for your flashlights. Prepare for 72 hours until the good, nice people from the government can get there and deliver the services again. But we're not talking about 72 hours if there's a major EMP event. We're talking possibly years, maybe a decade. No lights. Imagine the catastrophic results on a society so dependent on electricity. Never mind your addiction to your smartphone and Wii. We're talking about a long-term interruption in the delivery of goods and services essential to life. Hospitals, police, fire services, communication, transportation systems, the delivery of fresh water and food, the delivery of health care. None of these things happen without electricity. It would all come to a grinding halt. So now you're probably asking yourself, what the heck is an EMP? How does it happen? How likely is it to occur? What will really happen after such an event occurs? What's being done about this imminent threat? Well, for the next 45, 50 minutes, we're going to discuss all of that and more. Michael Maloof is a former senior security policy analyst in the Office of the Secretary of Defense in the United States. He is the author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. Michael, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm very good, Richard. Thank you for having me.
I was just reading recently how state lawmakers in Arizona are moving to make sure that the people in the state of Arizona are prepared for such an event, an EMP, or it could be a nuclear strike. But essentially what they're saying, if you read the legislation, is they're telling the people of Arizona, you're on your own, folks. Well, let's discuss exactly what an EMP threat is. And my understanding is there are a couple of ways that could come about, an EMP, mm-hmm. an electromagnetic pulse event. Let's talk about, first of all, a solar flare or a mass coronal ejection.
Mm-hmm. Well, an electromagnetic pulse is a high-intensity burst of electromagnetic energy caused by the rapid acceleration of charged particles. They are so powerful and supercharged that they can knock out or completely fry any unprotected electronics or electrical systems depending upon its intensity and its directness in terms of whether it hits you directly or just glances off. The aurora borealis that we see, for example, are solar flares from the sun, for example, that come close to the Earth, but don't quite hit it. Sometimes they'll affect our communications. If they're intense enough, they can affect even our satellites. They can affect they can even affect the astronauts on the space station.
And last week we had a massive
yes,
solar flare that knocked out radios. I guess it was in the Pacific Rim.
Yep. And I might add that the higher you go in the latitude, like where you all are, it's going to be even more intense because of your positioning to the North Pole. So that magnetic pole. So it's anything in the Western Hemisphere certainly would be affected greatly, and that's just from a natural cause from solar flares. And NASA has predicted. Our National Aeronautic and Space Administration, along with our National Academy of Sciences, say that if we had a direct hit from a solar flare, some of which can be some some on the magnitude of 14 to 20 times the size of the Earth. That's how massive these things can be. But if we got a direct hit, if it cost $2 trillion in the first year, just in the United States alone, it would take 4 to 10 years possibly to recover. And it would affect, I love that word, affect, about 90% of the U.S. population. Namely, people would die of starvation.
Right. Affect means
medical causes.
Right. Affect means death. Right. 90%
yes.
within the first
90%.
Year.
Yes.
What
and
a
it would
nightmare.
Virtually wipe out your, it would virtually wipe out your urban centers because urban centers are much more dependent than your rural areas. For the electricity, although there would be some burden on them too, but they would probably stand a better chance simply because they're able to grow their own. People are able to grow their own food. Oftentimes, they're able to go out hunting and what have you. But there are other risks. You could have marauding gangs, for example,
right.
going for the have-nots going after the haves.
Yeah, that thin veneer of civility. People, think, oh, how neighborly they were when the lights went out the last time. But that thin veneer of civility disappears after about, I'm guessing, what, maybe a week?
Less than that.
Less than that?
Well, it begins within hours. When we have natural disasters, grocery stores, for example, in the urban areas are stocked maybe for 3 days of food. The shelves are cleared out within hours.
Right.
So, and on top of that, in your urban centers, they because of their dependency on life-sustaining critical infrastructures such as food and water delivery, your sanitation, what have you, disease will be a secondary cause. Also, EMP can affect the flow of natural gas and oil through the pipelines because they would have an impact on the automated control systems that we just take for granted.
Right.
They could get knocked out. As a consequence, you're going to have unexpected explosions and fires. So the repercussions would be a cascading effect of disaster.
Water filtration plants. Water filtration plants are dependent on electricity. So no fresh water.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, we had such an event, but we didn't notice it back in the, was it the 1850s? It was called the Carrington event, but nobody really noticed. Why was that?
That's correct. And I think Quebec had an outage in 1989 from a solar flare, in fact, that affected the hydroelectric facility up there. And if it weren't for that impact, I think some 6 million people were affected by that over a course of days and weeks, and it began to come on down the U.S. East Coast, and if it weren't for, I believe, the station in the substation in Allegheny, New York, was able to stop it. Otherwise, it would have taken out the whole East Coast as well.
Michael Maloof is with us, the author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. We'll take a time out and come back and discuss with Michael how exactly these power grids are affected. How interconnected are they? And it's not just the delivery of electricity to your home. What about our national defense systems? How vulnerable would we be to outside incursions or attack or such an event were to occur? The threat of an electromagnetic pulse event is real, but what is being done about it? We'll find out when we come back. Stay with us. The solar storm of 1859, also known as the Carrington event, was this powerful geomagnetic solar storm during what's called a solar cycle 10, and a solar flare or coronal mass ejection hit our magnetosphere and induced the largest known solar storm, which was observed and recorded by Richard C. Carrington, hence the name, the Carrington Super Flare. The thing is that it wasn't readily apparent to a lot of people, unless you happen to be a telegraph operator, in which case you may have been electrocuted. That was because, think about it, in 1859, we weren't that dependent on electricity. But imagine a solar cycle 10. A coronal mass ejection hitting the Earth today. Well, that's what's staring us in the face. And that's not the only way it can happen. as we are about to discuss with Michael Maloof, the author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. All right, let's quickly discuss the other way an EMP could hit our shores.
Well, the other way would be man-made. And this is generally from a high-altitude nuclear explosion. We're watching North Korea very, very closely right now. They just announced that they can launch a missile that can go 10,000 miles, but it doesn't have to do that. All they have to do is orbit a satellite, and that satellite in turn could become the nuclear weapon, and it could be orbiting around 150 miles, and that thereby gives them the capability to explode it at that height on command anywhere in the world. And this is something we've been watching. If you'll recall, North Koreans in December of 2012, following a nuclear test, began to make overt threats to the United States of attacking the United States without warning. And they also made videos showing nuclear explosions in Washington and New York City. And the question was, why are they doing this, and how are they doing this, and how would they deliver it? And again, that satellite that they were able to successfully orbit could become, in effect, a nuclear weapon. Now, the testing that they've been doing has been low yield, and purposely so, because what our intelligence community is suggesting is that that low yield really is not so much for damage that you would have from a normal nuclear explosion, a large one of considerable numbers of kilotons, but it's designed to be made into what we call a super EMP, which emits tremendous amounts of gamma rays, more so than the normal nuclear device would.
So in the case of an EMP, bigger is not necessarily better when it comes to a nuclear bomb.
That's right. The more gamma rays that it can emit, the more damage it will do. And gamma rays are a form of electromagnetic energy, just like X-rays and your radars. Radars emit a microwave, and that you could put a terrorist could put a radar in the back of a truck, aim it at a building, and knock out electronics. And the thing is, you wouldn't know where it came from. And unfortunately, we have websites today that tell people how you can make an EMP weapon and how to upgrade it so that it becomes to scale so that it could be even more forceful.
So 150 miles above the Earth, that's the sweet spot?
That's anywhere from 150 to 300 miles. The higher you go, the more coverage you get. And if it's exploded over Kansas, it would cover all the continental United States.
It's been suggested that I'm sure you've heard this discussed, that, you know, you could commandeer a large aircraft, let's say a Boeing 777, and place some small nuclear device on there and fly it over and detonate it above the United States somewhere. Is that feasible?
Well, I think it would be difficult because all the planes have to be accounted for, and I think it would be shot down, hopefully. But
just like on 9/11?
You can do it with drones, sure. Yeah, you can do it with drones. Boeing just conducted a test in which they had EMP equipment that was aimed at a building and knocked out every computer in that building. And just by flying a drone over. And it doesn't have to be a nuclear weapon, per se. It can be a device that emits terrific amounts of microwaves. That's basically what they did to take out every computer in that building. It was a test.
All right.
But it was effective.
Well, there's an awful lot of chatter right now, and I mentioned the Arizona state legislators basically telling people, why is there all this chatter? Is there something we're not being told? How imminent is this threat?
Well, I think given the unsettledness of the world order these days, I think people are becoming increasingly concerned. anything can set off anybody at any time. Any country with a rocket and with a nuclear device is capable of launching an EMP. Your Russians, your Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Pakistanis, the Indians, even the Israelis, they all know about EMP and they all got a nuclear capability. And if, for example, say that the Pakistanis and the Indians got into it and exchanged nuclear devices, it would affect the world. Not only because of the radiation, but also because of high altitude. And they're very aware of EMPs. So given the unsettledness of things, and I might add, our air defense systems, our missile defense systems are not up to par in the United States. Now, the North Koreans, and I would say that those systems that we have are aimed toward the North Pole area, should there be a satellite or a rocket coming in from the North Pole. But what we've seen is that the North Koreans test going over the South Pole, and we do not have missile defenses from that direction. And I would add that because we don't have missile defenses, a number of our folks have been talking about having our Aegis anti-missile defense systems on our ships and on our land be able to take it out. There was a test of the Aegis system about 2 years ago in which it was successfully intercepted a rocket coming back into the atmosphere. It was about 150 miles. It had a lot of chemicals on it, and it was one of those rockets that basically fell out of orbit, was heading back to Earth, and it was successfully destroyed. So as an interim measure, we're talking about maybe trying to get more Aegis systems either on the sea or on the land to be aimed more toward the South Pole area, just in case the North Koreans want to do that. Now, you don't need to have that either. You can have a freighter off the coast and shoot up a missile, just a Scud missile with a rocket or with a nuclear device on it, and explode it over the megapolis, let's say, from the United States, from Boston to Washington, one of our heaviest population areas. It would knock out the eastern grid. We have three grids in the United States. It would knock out the eastern grid. But the eastern grid services some 70% of the U.S. population.
Now, how is it that, I mean, we can perhaps defend against a nuclear device which might produce an EMP, but we can't necessarily defend against a solar flare unless we take measures to shield our electronics and our grids. Why haven't we taken measures to properly shield our grid system?
Well, that's why I wrote the book. The U.S. federal government has known about this problem for years. They've known about it since the 1960s. And I called the book A Nation Forsaken because the federal government basically has let people down. DHS is very aware of it. The U.S. Defense Department is very aware of EMPs. We cannot get the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to make EMP attack one of their 15 planning scenarios. Now, those planning scenarios are very important because if there is an event, then those scenarios are kicked into effect on how to proceed. And the problem is that at the state and local levels, the first responders and the emergency services in the United States take their lead from the federal DHS. And if the DHS isn't going to do anything, they're not going to do anything. Right now, this minute, states are ill-prepared, even first responders are ill-prepared to deal with an EMP. And with an EMP, you have to assume all of your electronics and all of your communications goes out. And that would also include your emergency vehicles. I heard testimony last year from first responders in Massachusetts, in which they said that if their trucks were affected by an EMP, they would be knocked out. They wouldn't be able to respond. And if you don't have the communications, then the question is, what do people do? And I called the book A Nation Forsaken because the federal government has let people down. Now what we're doing, a number of us, through an EMP coalition that we've established and also through the EMP caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives, we're trying to get states of the United States now to take that initiative. And that's what has begun. In June of last year, state of Maine did pass, wanted to require hardening of their grid. Now, what Arizona just did was to at least tell people to be prepared and what to do on an individual basis and with your families. This is one of the things I raise in my book toward the end of it, what you can do at the personal level to prepare if all else fails, if all of your governments at the federal, state, and even local levels fail you. Well, this is what you need to do as an individual.
Yeah, I think I would direct people right to the back of the book as soon as they buy it because, quite frankly, I mean, let's be honest. Yeah. We how many times do we have to live through a Hurricane Sandy or a Katrina to realize, you know, the nice government folks ain't coming?
That's correct.
So, I mean, and how long does it...
It's going to be even worse because it will take months, maybe years, as you pointed out earlier in your introduction, and people will not be able to survive.
How do you what's involved in hardening, you know, the power grid?
Well, it takes money, but the amount of money that it takes is a fraction of what would be the cost if we didn't. As I said, NASA said just from a natural event, a direct hit from a solar flare would cost $2 trillion in the first year. We're estimating it would be no more than about up to $20 billion at most.
$20 billion.
Yeah.
Well, the Fed can print that in about 20 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, for the utilities, it's been an issue of cost. And what we would like to see done is that the federal government works with the states to make this a much higher priority to start working on that. Now, there has been our federal energy regulatory agency has now directed the utilities to do just that, to start hardening the grid. Now, it's all out for comment, and this takes time and because of the democratic process. But there is an effort underway right now with our what we call the FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to start taking some initiative out of concern for this. And I think the thing that really triggered it was cyber attacks. Now, if you can guard against an EMP, you can pretty much guard against a cyber attack. Cyber attack is very temporary. EMP could be permanent because of the damage and the destruction it would do to your transformers, to your transmission lines, and as you pointed out, frying these lines. And I would add, you know, during the Carrington event, those telegraph poles, even though they singed the wires and burned them out, they also created fires. That event in 1859, according to accounts I've read, actually created fires where the telegraph poles were, and the poles caught on fire, and some buildings collapsed, and even then they had effects. Of course, what people saw for the most part were 3 days of beautiful aurora borealis around the world.
Wow.
It wasn't just in the north.
Yeah, and those telegraphs, even though they were knocked offline because of the power surge, some of them continued to receive and send messages.
Without being connected.
Yes.
That's right.
Michael Maloof is with us, the author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, and The Threat of an American Catastrophe. The escalating threat of an American catastrophe. We'll take a time out, come back. We'll open up the phone lines, too, if you've got questions or comments. What can we do right now? Let's not wait for the nice government people to come and help us. Let's say there's a solar flare coming our way, something wicked this way comes, in the next couple of weeks. What can we do right now to protect ourselves as we discuss the threat of an EMP event here on The Conspiracy Show? Back with more in a moment. Stay with us. Once again, Michael Maloof is with us, former senior security policy analyst in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. Michael has almost 30 years of federal service in the U.S. Defense Department and as a specialized trainer for border guards and special forces in select countries of the Caucasus and Central Asia. While with the Department of Defense, Michael was director of technology security operations. As head of a 10-person team involved in halting the diversion of military critical technologies to countries of national security and proliferation concern, and those involved in sponsoring terrorism. Now, I want to get back to the shielding and hardening of the power grids. You mentioned, you know, the cost $20 billion, but how long does it take? Is it a lengthy process? Let's say they get the green light to do it.
Well, if we got the green light to do it, it would take if it was a concerted effort, it would probably take a good 5 years. What's happening is that with our grid system, we're putting more and more demand on it all the time. Even though we're upgrading, we're still not putting in the hardened chips, those kind of electronics that can withstand radiation. And that's the kind of thing that we need to be impressing upon them to do, the utilities and even state commissions to mandate that. And what we're trying to do now is get the states to require the utilities to start doing that. Now, we've gotten some positive feedback from Texas, New York, North Carolina, Maine, certainly, and now Arizona in talking about preparation. But Arizona's situation is still not sufficient as far as we're concerned, but it's a beginning, and we have to. I do applaud them for at least recognizing this problem and taking the action that they have to date, and hopefully there'll be follow-up. But it will take some time, and we're really on borrowed time at the moment for two reasons. Number one, the sun is going through a cycle right now. It's an 11-year cycle in which we could begin to realize the most intense period, what they call a solar storm maximum. And this can go on for the rest of this year and well into next year because it has to degrade over time. And if that and a flare can whip off that sun at any time, and if there's a spot on the sun that's aligned with the Earth, we're in trouble.
How have we managed to dodge that bullet for the last 160 years?
We're past due. They estimate they came in about once every 100 to 150 years. So we're on borrowed time right now.
And how dependent is the defense system on these power grids? One would assume that they would have their own sort of, you know, a power grid system that would be heavily shielded. But how dependent are they on the power grid that the rest of us poor slobs are?
Well, all of our military bases in the United States rely upon the civilian grid 99%.
Oh, my gosh. It's almost laughable if it weren't so tragic, the implications.
Well, what they have done is harden some of their weapon systems, some of your offensive weapon systems, the F-35s, the B-2s, but not the bases, not the they're working on microgrids, but that's a very experimental thing. I would add that hospitals would be dramatically affected as well, but in terms of preparedness and readiness, this is of concern. Now, the one other thing that we noticed, you'll recall that there was a North Korean ship that was halted in the Panama Canal, had just come out of Cuba.
Right, I remember that.
What they found was an SA-2, which is a surface-to-air missile. It's an old Soviet-era missile. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62, the emphasis and the focus was on the surface-to-surface missiles that were taken out. But they were not focused on the surface-to-air missile, which nuclear capable.
It'll get the job done. It may be old, but it'll get the job done.
It'll get the job done. And it was going, and we assess that Cuba has maybe about 100 of these right now because they were never taken out. And if they're being sent back and forth to North Korea for modernizing and upgrading, then it's a problem.
We used to have this idea of mutually agreed destruction. Now, when it comes to EMP, mm-hmm. let's say warfare based on EMP events, are the enemies of NATO, let's say call them NATO and NORAD's enemies, real or perceived, are their power grids as equally vulnerable?
Yes.
Okay.
There's all the power. If you're relying upon the electrical grid system, they don't have independent grid systems. But they are working. What they are working on, of course, they have generators. But you know, dependent upon how much fuel you have to fuel that generator, if it doesn't have any electronics in it, it could go out within a week. Same with hospitals. Hospitals will immediately switch over to the generators and run for about 3 to 5 days. What should also be of concern to people would be your nuclear power stations. They can cause overheating and then meltdowns, and you would have Fukushima's all over the place.
Oh my word!
And a lot of them are built on not just on your fault lines, but if an EMP were to hit, and again they work on generators as well, and again their limitation is the amount of fuel that's available to fuel them, and if you have an EMP, the ability to transport fuel to receive fuel will also be greatly hampered.
Which of the...
You may not be able to get it all.
No, indeed. Which of the two causes of an EMP has you most worried on this particular day? Is it the solar flare or is it a terrorist attack?
Not so much a terrorist attack. I would say a solar flare right now because it can happen at any time. We're right in the midst of that, and our national grid system setup is so overtaxed right now and vulnerable. You know, if a squirrel can knock out a line in Ohio and take out the East Coast, that's pretty serious and pretty sad. And that's exactly what's happened.
How much advance notice would we have?
None.
None.
Oh, well, you would have a few hours seeing the flare coming down, but you wouldn't have absolutely no time to prepare. No time to prepare. You would have warning that something was coming down, and it travels at terrific speeds. You're talking hours.
Well, when we come back, Michael, we'll have about 15 minutes to prepare our listeners.
Okay.
A Herculean task, but we'll do our best. Back with more of my conversation with Michael Maloof, the author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, the Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. It goes without saying, we're not here to cause mass panic, but this threat is real. It's not getting the attention that it deserves. We're talking about the imminent threat of an EMP, an electronic or electromagnetic pulse event, which could knock out power grids across the continent, leaving us to freeze in the dark for a decade, perhaps. It would take that long, conceivably, to bring the power back on, to bring the lights back on. And just think about how all of our activity is so dependent upon electricity. The delivery of essential services, food, fresh water, fuel, medicine, police services, fire services, defense, all dependent on the grid. And once it goes down, the delivery of all of those things comes to a grinding, sudden halt. Back in the dark ages. What do you do? Michael Maloof is with us, and again, the book is A Nation Forsaken, EMP, the Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. Let's call it a North American catastrophe. We're all in the same boat here. So let's flip to the back of the book quickly, Michael. What do we do? Let's say we live in an urban center. What do you recommend we do?
Well, people are limited by what resources they have, and if they can stock up some stuff and also have alternative plans, they should have a plan in effect on where to go and what to do, because the urban center is going to become uninhabitable before very long, and it's going to be chaos, I'm afraid.
So we need a rural retreat. We need a rural retreat.
Basically, you need one. And one of the things that I was that I mentioned in the book is that there should be predetermined plans already mapped out by communities on where to go for food, water, medicines. People only keep about a month's worth of medication on hand. And And there should be prescribed places only because you have to assume that all communications will be knocked out. People should be informed where they need to report to and what they need to do, so that otherwise it's just people are going to be running around like crazy. We've seen it just with other natural disasters on a far lesser scale.
But you're saying, you know, if everyone is trying to get out of Dodge and get to their cottage or get to their cave or wherever, I mean, that's mm-hmm. going to be chaos too, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I mean,
there's no happy ending to this. It's the beginning. It's going to be the beginning of the end, basically. It would be a very catastrophic development.
So, I mean, there is an argument for sort of grouping together in a community rather than everyone heading off to their, you know, their 50 acres. And
if you have a place, that's fine. If not, communities, even within the urban environment, need to organize and be able to know what to do, where to go, and how to proceed. And but no one's that organized anywhere that I'm aware of.
No, and I mean, unless you are adept at self dentistry and advanced first aid.
Sure.
You know, carpentry, all of those things, and if you can't do it on your own.
No, you cannot. That's why we need to really, and the book talks about some of the survivalist things that we should be bringing back. Our survivalist instincts are gone because of technology. We've relied upon technology for so long in our day and age that we really don't know how to survive such an event if we were catapulted back to the 19th century.
Let's say you have some electronics, I don't know, a hand crank radio or something like that. I mean, they would be vulnerable as well, I'm guessing. How do you protect those valuable pieces of equipment that would come in really? A generator, for example. How do you protect that stuff?
Well, there are such things as Faraday cages. They could become expensive. They basically are sealed steel boxes. And you would want to have your a spare phone with batteries and a radio already in the Faraday cage in order to just in case something happens. Because if you're on your cell phone and this event occurs, it's out. That phone's broken. And you won't be able to use it again, simply because of the electronics that are in it.
Now,
I would add, even the ability to communicate, the transmissions of it will be affected. Now, in the United States, they have been working on an emergency system, and I don't know that it's up to speed to deal with an EMP. This is when the president comes on and announces an emergency and all that, the emergency system, national emergency system. It's not up to speed to deal with an EMP.
Just received this email from a listener who goes by the handle The Dude, and he writes, in the USA and Canada, ham radio operators, do a 24-hour emergency disaster communication drill every third weekend in June called Field Day. And then he says, okay, fourth weekend in June. In a nutshell, thousands of stations set up portable or mobile two-way stations that must work off-grid. So you can use a vehicle generator, battery, solar, etc., to set up a multi-band station and make as many contacts as possible in a 24-hour period. And the dude says he's done quite a few of these with various amateur radio groups, or he's loaded his radios and gear, loaned, I think he means, his radios and gear out to those groups if he had to work. Are you familiar with these field day events?
I've heard of them. Again, if there's electronics in their system, they're going to get knocked out.
Right, unless they're properly shielded in a Faraday cage.
Unless exactly.
Now, if you have if your plan is to get out of Dodge, so this EMP event occurs, how are you going to get out of Dodge? I mean, the electronic components in your car are going to be fried.
That's true too. Well, I think we need to bring back the civil defense systems that we used to have in the 50s at the beginning of the Cold War. We really need to reinstitute those, put them in the community so that people know where to report to and where to go. There you had food that was stocked and and people were people drilled, and they had the means to survive. This is in lieu of the government doing nothing about hardening the system. If we're able to harden the system, then you mitigate the problem tremendously, and it should be done on a priority basis with your communications and what have you. But none of that is being done right now. So I think in lieu of that, the states ought to come back in with local civil defense facilities where people know where they can report to, and everything is set up and stocked, ready to go in the event of such an event.
Would you say that this is the number one threat to our security right now?
Right now, yes, because if we had an EMP attack or even an EMP event, it's our ability to respond would be very, very limited. First of all, we may not even know where it came from. Let's say if it was a man-made event, we may not even know who instigated it unless we had some really great intelligence, and that's questionable.
And you say that they've known about this for the last 50 years, yet have done virtually nothing about it.
Correct. We had, in 2008, there was a congressionally mandated EMP commission that talked about what the impact of an EMP event would be on our life-sustaining critical infrastructures. And it was devastating. And it would be a cascading effect. You knock out one of those critical infrastructures, it affects all of them. And we're talking quite a number of them, anywhere from 8 to 18, depending upon what you're looking at. I mean, we're talking about, in addition to the grid system, our telecommunications, our banking and finance systems. I mean, it can knock out your databases. You wouldn't even know how much money you had in your accounts. It can knock out the petroleum and natural gas delivery systems, our transportation system, food and water delivery, emergency services, as well as our space systems, among others. All of these would be affected instantly.
So obviously you want to have a little, I'd say you'd have a little cash on hand, but for what? I mean, it's going to be bedlam.
Yeah, for what?
Exactly.
Yeah, the cash would be worthless. People are going to want your guns. They're going to want your food. They're going to want your medications and any other possessions you might have.
And if you have shielded, let's say you've taken steps and you've shielded your generator, so your generator is operating, and that's just going to be a beacon to all those marauding gangs out there to come to your place.
Yeah, and that's why we feel, we have our Second Amendment right to bear arms and what have you in the United States. I think Canada has a different situation.
Oh, we gave that up a long time ago, yes.
Well, what are you going to do if these gangs could start roaming? How do you defend yourself?
Exactly. No, we cower under the bed and call 911. Oh, shoot, we can't do that either.
No, cannot do that. We can do.
You know, it's frustrating. It's beyond frustrating to know that they've known. I say the government has known about this for 50 years. They've done almost nothing. You've described this as the number one threat, and yet, what are they pouring their resources into? Training TSA officials to pat down 90-year-old Amish grandmothers in case they have a shoe bomb. It's maddening.
Well, there's no priorities. We have no priorities anywhere these days, and you can just see by the confusion that we're having to deal with on a daily basis in terms of our national and foreign policies. There are none. We're only reacting to events. We don't have a plan, and we should have plans for these kinds of events. And we're not thinking in those terms. There's supposed to be a hearing next week in the U.S. House on EMP. They're going to have a hearing. The utilities will object, and that'll be the end of it. Every year this happens, and then nothing ever occurs. Now, we've had what's called the SHIELD Act to pass the House about three times, never passed the Senate, U.S. Senate. The SHIELD Act would mandate hardening of everything so that we would be able to withstand an EMP.
Yeah.
As I said, we're not going to get away without a scratch, but we can at least guard the most critical infrastructures that we would have to rely upon until which time we can come back. Our transformers, for example, our very large transformers are all foreign made. And we it takes about 3 years to get another one in. We don't keep them in surplus because of their tremendous cost, and they have to be specially designed. Look at what happened down in San Jose. People were shooting up Transformers. They shot out 17 Transformers with an AK-47.
Right.
They still don't know who did it. Now, was this a prelude to something larger that's to come? Well, who knows? I mean, that's the thinking of some of us, that this is a possibility of a domestic terrorism on a larger scale that could occur by hitting those Transformers. And the DHS had a report that was leaked that basically said if you hit 9 Transformers in the United States, and they would not identify those 9 Transformers, if you hit those, then it would knock out all electricity in the United States.
Wow, what a lovely scenario you've painted for us. Michael, listen, I appreciate the time you've spent with us tonight. And again, the book is A Nation Forsaken, EMP, The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. That's available through WorldNet Daily Books, or WND now, we should call it, WND.
Yes.
Thank you again, Michael.
Well, thanks for having me, Richard. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right, the website, richardserrett.com. Hey, don't forget to subscribe. I get to 500 subscribers, and I'll start publishing the weekly newsletter. In the meantime, follow the truth. Thanks for inviting me into your home and your head. And thank you for your ears and your voices. Emerson wrote, "Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. The virtue in most request is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion." What was Ralph Waldo on about there, I wonder? Think about it. In order for a people to rule, or to be ruled effectively, instead of government of the people, by the people, for the people, we're ruled. We are ruled, make no mistake. Some of us, many of us, God, maybe even most of us, are stumbling towards the apocalypse with drool on our chins, and we're quite content to be ruled. And the elites are quite happy to return the favor. They're quite happy to rule over us. So how do they do that? Well, they convince society, your neighbor, your colleague, that guy you carpool with, to demand conformity. But you, dear listener, you don't run with the herd, which is why you listen to shows like this. You're not a conformist. You think for yourself. And that's dangerous. That can't be tolerated. And so all of society is in a conspiracy against all of its members. The virtue in request, the virtue in most request, is conformity. It begins in public school. They demand conformity. You try and fight it. You try and think for yourself. But everywhere, the supermarket, the golf course, the PTA meeting, your nonconformist ways are challenged and despised. You're not one of us. You're not normal. Your child should be on medication. Sorry, we're making some changes here at work and you don't fit in with our new direction. In other words, you don't fit in with the company culture. You think for yourself. You can't be a cop if you're a nonconformist. You can't run for political office and win if you're a nonconformist. You can't host the morning show on a major radio station if you're a nonconformist. Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of us and its members. The virtue in most request is conformity. And what else do rulers despise? What makes their job of ruling over a people very difficult? Self-reliance. What's that you say? You're off the grid? You homeschool your kids? You grow your own food? You own a gun and you're prepared to defend yourself, your home and your family? You don't call 911 and cower under the bed? You resent paying taxes? Why? You sound like an extremist. Next thing you'll be telling me is you own gold outside the banking system. Let's put that person on a no-fly zone and monitor their emails. Darn. They don't own a computer or a cell phone. They're off the grid. Quick, let's raise their property taxes and get them off that land and into the city where we can keep an eye on them. Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. Self-reliance is its aversion. We all need to get busy, very busy, and get self-reliant. If you're not, and admittedly I am not, we need to get self-reliant fast. Next week is Emergency Preparedness Week, and the nice government people want you to take measures to protect yourself and family in case of some emergency. A power outage, an earthquake, a mudslide, a tornado. It all depends on what region of North America you reside. They want you to have enough fresh water and food stores and maybe some extra batteries and flashlights at the ready, enough to last 72 hours. You're going to hear a lot about that. 72 hours. That's 3 days. Until the nice government people can restore services, the nice government people can restore electricity or distribution of food and water. 72 hours, 3 days. We have short memories. Think back to the ice storm we had here this past December. How many of you were essentially on your own for several weeks? No nice government people were there to help you. Ask people who lived through Sandy or Katrina. Where were the nice government people then? The lesson is we need to prepare ourselves for an eventuality where the nice government people won't be coming to help. Of course, we talked recently about an EMP event that could turn out the lights across North America for years. By some estimates, within a year, up to 90% of the population would be, quote-unquote, affected. What they mean is dead. That's how utterly dependent we are on the power grid. That's how vulnerable we are. And state governments in the U.S., states like Arizona, are now busy letting their people know, if such an event were to occur, essentially, you're on your own. We need to start thinking like that. We are on our own. Self-reliance. Dare to prepare. 72 hours is probably not going to get it done. What if the lights don't come on after 3 days or 3 weeks or 3 months? Then what? Let's discuss for the next hour, shall we? Self-reliance. A valuable attribute in troubling times, self-reliance. That's going to be a real important attribute in the rocky days ahead when we have our mettle tested, perhaps like no other generation. So just tuck that Emerson quote away, someplace handy where you can find it and reflect upon it in the coming days. The lesson is we need to prepare for an eventuality where the lights might stay off indefinitely. Let's discuss. Stan Deo has held above top secret security clearance and worked undercover for the FBI. He was part of an exclusive black project headed by Dr. Edward Teller, specializing in the development of flying saucer technology. But he's also the author of a number of books, including Dare to Prepare. He served as host for several television programs on inventor Nikola Tesla and as a series of three highly rated shows on Channel 9 in Perth, Australia. UFOs Are Here, UFOs, Deo, and You, and UFOs Are Back. But he's here on The Conspiracy Show to talk about emergency preparedness. Stan, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Good. Thank you, Richard. Just want to correct one little thing there. The book that would probably be most germane to what research I've done is The Cosmic Conspiracy. Now, Holly, my wife, wrote the Dare to Prepare book.
So, well, it's all in the family.
It is. It is indeed. And I tell you what, we talk preparedness and do preparedness around here all the time. And it's getting more and more a necessity for people, isn't it?
I recently spoke with Michael Maloof, the author of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, and The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. And again, I mean, I don't know how you talk about this without scaring people to death, but this is the stark reality that an EMP is what's staring us in the face. We are in the midst of a solar cycle where a solar flare is quite possible. We could have another Carrington event. And this time, of course, we're not just talking about knocking telegraphs offline. We are talking about virtually every aspect of human activity coming to a grinding halt. And quite frankly, Michael Maloof painted a pretty grim picture. How do you perceive an EMP threat?
Well, I perceive it as a very real threat, either by act of war from some of our enemies, enemy nation states, or from the sun itself, as you mentioned just a few seconds ago. We've had two spots, two very active beta-gamma magnetic field spots on the sun rotate into a position where if they had had an M-class flare, and they were possible, that they were aimed at the Earth. Now, I think it was 2049, 2047, and 7's already gone by now, and 49 will drift by in a couple of days, and maybe we'll be out of harm's way there. When we start talking about areas on the sun that can throw out a flare and then most times a coronal mass ejection right behind it, in the areas of the sun that are very intense like that, if they are capable of putting out an X-class flare, say, an X-30 or 40, something like that, that would be extremely serious. And so whenever you hear, on spaceweather.com or on the radio that the sun is might produce an X-class flare, or it has just produced one, if it was aimed at the Earth, you won't be able to do anything about it, because by the time they detect it, it will have hit us and fried, that side of the Earth anyway. Most of the electronics that aren't grounded or in safety, Faraday cage type things, will be zapped and will not work again. But there are a lot of things that can do that, and people have said, oh, look, that'll wipe out telephones, communication, blah, 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 and computers will go down. So we'll put a spare computer, a radio, in a Faraday cage of some description. And I said to him, well, okay, that's good. Do you know when the EMP is going to come from the sun, or when Russia or China are going to attack us with an EMP? Well, no. So you might be using the stuff that you've put away, or would put away into a safety area, like a Faraday cage, when it hits, and it won't do any good to have the Faraday cage. Oh, yeah, but I'll be operating on my computer and listen to the radio, and I'll have a spare in the Faraday cage. I said, well, how many spares are you going to have? Because you're prepared for one, and if you use your spare after the EMP has fried everybody else's stuff, and you're using it, and a second one hits you, then, well, you better have, a third backup, and a fourth, and a fifth. And it gets to a point of ridiculous after a while. So I said, you better be thinking about, okay, I might have one backup of things that that are key to communication, find out what's going on. But other than that, you better be preparing for how to go back to the horse and buggy age and survive with your neighbors.
So the whole Faraday cage and shielding and protecting your devices is really folly, is what you're saying. We need to learn how to live the way our ancestors did.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not folly entirely, but you're going to be, it's like we say in gambling, it's a crapshoot, it's a gamble, because you don't know how many or when and from where an EMP situation will come. And with the current situation worldwide and the Middle East and Ukraine, we're kind of pushing the envelope a bit, and I think that we could see a nuclear war or the beginning of it fairly shortly.
Stan, I want to point out that you've got a number of interesting images, maps, graphs, and so forth, dozens of them, that are posted on your website, standeo.com, and I just want to give out the URL here, if people want to log on during the show and look at these as we discuss.
The simple way to do that, Richard, would be to say go to standeo.com.
Right.
S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O.com. And if you just scroll down just a quarter of a page or so, on the right you'll see a picture of a microphone, like a drawing of a microphone. And it'll say show images. Click on that and it'll take you straight to it.
Excellent. So go to standeo.com and you'll see a microphone. And it says show images. Click on that, and you'll see, for example, a map of an EMP radius of damage in North America. You'll see a EMP radius of damage over central USA, photographs of blasts, nuclear blasts, and much, much more. Stan Deo is with us, and we'll discuss how to prepare and survive a catastrophe. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Stan Deo is with us, emergency preparedness expert, StanDeo.com, the website. And again, if you go to Stan Deo, that's Stan, S-T-A-N, Deo, D-E-Y-O.com, and scroll down, and you'll see a sketch of a microphone there. And just right beside that, to the right of that, it says show images. If you click on that, that'll take you to the maps and graphs and images that we've been discussing. And you can have a look at those while you're listening to our conversation. I really want to focus on, you know, how to survive. When I was speaking with Michael Mallow recently, we sort of, you know, went through the all the gory details of how this EMP will impact us, and it's pretty grim, obviously. But let's see if we can give people some hope here.
Sure.
How do you, Stan? How do you live? I mean, are you off the grid? Do you have a plan in place to get out of Dodge and live off the land?
Well, actually, here in Colorado, we have about a little over 1.5 acres around us, and we've Holly, my wife, has pioneered 4x4 and 4x8 foot intensive gardening. She's written a book or two on it, and spoken quite a bit on our website about it to show people how to weather things in situ, you know, in their homes if they can't get to a place out away from the city. Certainly it's not a good idea for people to live in any of the 120 major nuclear target cities in the United States, and she's listed those out in her book, the Dare to Prepare book. But we try to encourage people to build community around them, and here's why. If you go out into the bush, into the local forest or whatever, and think you're going to go out there and survive off the land, it's not going to happen for everyone. In fact, it's going to be very difficult because of the government's high-tech ways to find you, you know, infrared and various other things that would give your position away eventually. So, you know, and if you were out there in a camp by yourself with your family, maybe two or three kids and your wife, okay, and you can have all the guns in the world you want, but it's going to take people, you know, being on guard duty while others sleep, and it's a very involved process to try to live, you know, in a Wild West situation out in the bush, especially since a lot of these areas are being swallowed up by Agenda 21 and are probably populated by Russian troops or UN troops or something we don't know about, but they're just, you're not as protected as you think out in the wilderness. A small group of one person on foot and traveling might, you know, be okay, maybe two, but you're going to encounter a lot of problems out there. So we've been teaching people to get to know their neighbors and to live away from the major cities so that you have less population problems to deal with when people get hungry and start forming gangs and roll around. You know, just a case in point, in New York in 1977 when they had the 24-hour power outage, in one night, the looting and raiding that occurred in New York caused 3,700 and some odd people to be arrested. And that was about half of who actually committed crimes that they caught. Now, in one day, now if you get an EMP, either from the sun or the enemy or whatever, it wipes out power for months, maybe years, imagine what it's going to be like. It'll be like a Mad Max scenario.
Right, so, it's a pretty thin veneer of civility. We often try and convince ourselves that when things are at their worst, we're at our best, but that grows tired after a few days, doesn't it?
It does, and you know, when it comes down to it, the head of a household will say, "Well, you know, I'm a fireman normally, but I'm now going to take care of my family because my family comes first. So I'm not going to fight fires for you, you know, and if any fire trucks are working in that time, but." You know, this is why you need to have neighbors and friends that you can get together and run, you know, alternate, stand watch at alternate times in the neighborhood and have some kind of a little communication system, whether it be, you know, string and can or whatever, so that you can say, look, I've got problems coming in over here. You know, we need your help. Come to my house or, you know, run across the back fence. You need weapons. You need ammunition, and the government's trying to take those away, as is often discussed. And they don't want you to be able to resist. They want to declare martial law when things get bad. but there are not enough troops in the United States that are, you know, would be completely faithful, you know, and obedient to the White House and to give orders to start shooting American citizens. It's just not going to work. There aren't enough of them, and even with Russians and U.N. troops, it's going to be very hard to put everybody under the thumb. So, you need to be able to cook, you need to be able to heat and possibly cool your home or a living area without power, without electric power anyway. It is time to start preparing by getting a hold of things that will, allow you to mitigate the effects of an EMP on your electronic devices you hope to keep intact. And then, you want to get solar cookers and you can make tea in a glass jug with water and tea bags. So buy some extra tea and store it away. Coffee, same thing. And, you know, you can cool yourself like you do in India and Australia in some places out in the outback, getting some, it's not muslin cloth, but it's like, they call it couscous tatty in India, but it's like a very coarse weave cloth, burlap, that's what I was looking for. And you can make strips of that, and if you've got access to water, you keep that moist and let the ambient breezes blow through that and cool you off a bit in a small area. You know, that's heating and cooling.
Stan, I'm sorry to interject, but if I could get you just to speak up, the phone connection is not great. I just want to make sure everyone is hearing this.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's better.
I realize that. Is that a little bit better?
That's much better.
Mic position.
Okay, there we go. That's much better.
Okay, and, you know, so, okay, food is going to be a big issue. You don't want to be standing in food lines and handouts from FEMA and stuff like that. So you must have these things on your property and store it away quietly. Don't make a big deal about it if you do store things, because I'm sure there'll be a point in time when the government, whether it be local or federal, will say, folks, we're in a time of crisis, and as you know, food supplies are very limited. So there have been a bunch of people hoarding food, you know, these prepper, you know, terrorist types. So if you know anybody in your neighborhood that's been doing that, let us know, and we'll share some of their booty with you. And we'll give you 5 or 10% of it for your own household, but we need to distribute that food around so your neighbors will rat on you. You know, one of them will somewhere. So you don't want to make it widely known what you've got. And you will need to have food and water. And we've put in our place, we couldn't dig a well. A, couldn't afford it, and B, if we could go down 1,200 feet and still not hit water where we are. So we got in some plastic storage tanks like they used in the Gulf War.
Right, right. Where do you get those?
Well, now, we got them in a crowd. You know, I'd have to look it up in your next break, and I'll tell you. But we got ours here. I think it's in Denver, and they're spun. You know, they're spinning around, so they're very thick. And you can get them from, you know, a couple hundred gallons to, you know, in our case, we got several of them that are like 2,500 gallons and made arrangements to catch rain in the time of crisis, not now because it's illegal. But to catch rain off a roof and throw it into these tanks and then filter it.
Let me just stop you there, Stan. Did you just say it's illegal to catch rain and store it?
Well, where we are, yeah. Yeah. There was a lawsuit between Kansas, which is east of us, and Colorado years back, 20, 30 years ago. And they wanted us to stopping or holding back the water over here that was normally running into the Arkansas River and into Kansas. And so it became illegal for you to catch water or to stop water in its natural flow downhill over to Kansas. And, you know, as long as you didn't make a big deal about it, people got away with it that needed the water in the mountain communities. In the more populated cities and stuff here, you know, it became obvious that you were breaking the rules and somebody had a nasty on for you, they could report you. But, you know, there are ways around that. But in Australia, for instance, we left there in 2001. We sold our farm and came back up here. It got to the point down there in that socialist country where they were going to start putting a tax with a little meter on our water tanks, and they were going to tax the rainwater.
Tax the rainwater.
Yep.
Oh, my Lord. Now, once you store the water, you store the rainwater, how do you purify it? How do you keep it clean and so forth?
Well, there are a couple of ways. In the downspouts that catch the water coming off your roof, you'll have dirt and, you know, bird droppings and things on the roof. You don't want that in your water, or not much of it anyway. You'll get some no matter what. But there's a little gizmo that will divert the early few minutes of a rainfall. It'll divert it so it doesn't go down into your tank that you've got storing the water. And after it's thought that the roof is clean, okay, it'll now close that little flap door, and it'll start putting this rainwater into your tank. Now, you'll still get sediment and junk in there, to say. A lot of it will just settle down. In Holly's book, the Dare to Prepare book, and I think even on our website in the preparedness section, there are instructions about how many, you know, teaspoons or, you know, drops, et cetera, of chlorine, which kinds of chlorine, powder or liquid, to use for so many gallons of water to purify. And then after you've done that, you want to filter out the junk that's in there, you know, the turbidity that's in there, just little chunks of things. And you put that through, say, something like a Berkey water filter. We have two or three of them here in the house, and we use them all the time now anyway, because these will filter out even, you know, viruses and bacteria and stuff like that. And they don't require power or pressure from the mains. You just pour the water in and let it trickle down through the filters and then put it into your cup and drink it. You do need, in some cases, if you've got very dirty water, you know, a lot of chunks and stuff in it and some dirt maybe, you do need to make a little pre-filter, and you can do that by putting some sand and some charcoal in a bucket, you know, with a little drain at the bottom of it and an open top, just to get rid of all the junk, you know, the heavy stuff that would clog your fine filters, like in the Berkey.
Right.
And once you've done that, that's a pre-filter, then you filter your water and drink it, and it's quite safe, and a lot of the bacteria and junk that would normally harm you is filtered out. And these filters, like, we've got them, each filter will run through about, at least 10, maybe 15,000 gallons of water before you got to think about changing it. That's a lot. I mean, anyway, that'll last you for most of the emergency time, I'm sure. And if you've got a tank to store it in, you know, even a few hundred gallons, then you know where you can go off in a bicycle and fill up jugs and stuff with town water or lake or whatever, that's, you know, junk water. As long as you can go get the water, you can bring it back and store it and purify and clean it. I mean, you know, you can get, like, this certain types of powdered chlorine powder that you clean your swimming pool with.
Right.
And that will just, that'll clean tens of thousands of gallons in one of those little 4 or 5 pound white plastic containers. So that'll last you a long time. It's better than liquid chlorine because that stuff goes off in 6 to 12 months. It's not as powerful.
Right.
Powder, it will stay a lot longer.
What about now food? You say you live on about an acre and a half, and you know, there are these seed magazines, or these seed catalog companies online, and they have these emergency seed stores that'll you know, for a 1 acre garden, and they tell you exactly, you know, what kind of things you should be planting, a lot of heritage plants and so forth, tomatoes and cabbage and all these things. But how most people do not know how to grow a plant, a tomato plant, or store. And canning, as you know, that died off with our grandparents. And we got to learn how to do that stuff again, Stan.
Well, you do. And now Holly has, in her book, it's got like 69 or 70 chapters. I forget now. We've added a couple in the last couple of years. But she tells you how to make your own soap, what you need, what chemistry, how to stir it, how to cook it, that kind of stuff. She tells you how to make 4x4 gardens in a book called Garden Gold. It's an electronic book you can just download off of our you know, our shopping cart there. I think it's like $12 or something, and it's several hundred pages of color pictures and explanations about how to do, you know, growing trees, growing plants, and how to make it concentrated so you don't have to go out there and you know, have a plow and plow up a half acre and you know, and weed it. That's one of the big things that you have trouble with in a normal garden. But this is using a technique the Chinese developed, and it's intensive gardening, which means, say, like in a 4-foot by 4-foot little bed that you build with some, you can buy it from Frame It All, just these plastic wood boards that build it up about 8 inches tall. And you fill that with a special soil mix that you can make out of it. She tells you how to do that, too. What percentage of, you know, cow manure, sheep manure, and you know, the various things, you know, peat moss and all these things you need to make a perfect soil. And we do that here. I mean, we just finished today with our early planting. Now, we had seeds we were growing inside the house. We tell you how to do that, too, show you pictures of how we've done it, because city dwellers have just been cut off from the land. So you need to get ready to do that, and it's a learning curve.
Well, how many of those 4x4 gardens do you need to, let's say, feed a family of four?
Well, let's see. I I can't quote the figure right off the top of my head. I know it's not many. 404. Say 1, 2, 3. You probably need about 8 to 10 of them.
Okay.
And you're not going to, I mean, these are things you just, I mean, I made my 4x4s originally by hand. I just went down to Lowe's and got some timber and cut it and, you know, nailed it together. And the thing you got to watch, though, you got to look out for birds, and you got to look out for rabbits and mice getting into your stuff.
Right.
So you have to get this netting and stretch it around it, especially when the plants are young, because there are some birds that will go down and peck at it and just uprooted looking for worms and stuff that might be around the roots of it. I speak from experience. I mean, we bought a couple of air rifles here just to get rid of some of what we call the hook bills, which are curved bill thrashers or something like that. And they got yellow eyes and they're a nasty bird. They dive in and they just rip your plants out.
Don't shoot till you see the yellow in their eyes.
You bet.
Listen, Stan, well, I got to take a time out. We'll come back and I want to find out exactly maybe what crops we should be growing. And we'll talk about other essential items, maybe that we need to be hoarding.
Yeah, I've got some information on this EMP protection stuff that people ought to hear.
We'll do that when we come back. Stan Deo, as we talk about preparing for a cataclysmic event. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome back. You know, the day could be slowly approaching or quickly approaching, where each of us may have to trade in our company identification badges for a shovel and a pair of overalls and become micro-farmers. We're talking with Stan Deo about how to prepare for some impending cataclysmic event, natural or man-made. And we've discussed, you know, water storage. Now we're discussing food, growing food, micro-farming, planting for the seasons. We need to know about natural insect repellents. We need to know about seed collection, seed storage. You know, most of us have no experience, zero experience with planting anything. You know, a tomato comes from the grocery store. It just magically appears there. But when the proverbial SHIT hits the fan, we need to start doing these things for ourselves. So, Stan, if we're going to grow an emergency garden, and you talked about these 4x4 gardens, and let's say for a family of four, you need 8 to 10 of them, what do you think are the essential crops that you should be growing?
Well, you have to look at nutrition, and even though corn is nice, it takes up a lot of space, and it's not as nutritious as, say, green beans or snap peas, snow peas, or lettuce or spinach. These are iron and zinc compounds in those. Carrots are good. Carrots, you can grow a lot of carrots in a 4x4 bed there. What Holly has done in that Garden Gold book is she's shown you how many of what kind of seed you can put in 1 square foot. What's the intensive growing? I mean, when I say intensive, you pack them in, and they're so tightly packed in there, and the soil is so rich that you make up that you don't need to weed it, because the actual crop you've planted, whatever the vegetable is, forces all the others out. It takes over. And, like, we were giving away lots of tomatoes last year to our neighbors and stuff because, what did we have? We had 2, 3. I think we had 4 tomato bushes in a 4x4. And we got so many tomatoes, we could not eat them all. And during the winter, we even got a grow light here, and we plugged it in, and we grew the tomatoes inside. There's a learning curve there, too, but then we were getting really good tomatoes. It tastes like a tomato, not cellophane painted red, you know.
You can grow tomatoes inside in the winter. Can you grow asparagus and broccoli inside?
Well, asparagus is a little trickier. It takes a while to grow, and you need a lot of area to let its roots spread out, and it's... We've done it, but we didn't do it inside. We do it out the back. In the best case, what you would do is make you up some of these little miniature greenhouses, what they are. They're just things that are about 2 or 3 feet tall in the peak of it, and you put them over your 4x4, and you let the sun heat those. There's a way to let the sun shine on it, and dark dirt and stuff like that will hold the heat in, and you can insulate it, and so you can actually grow outside during the winter. Within reason, if you got 4 feet of snow on top of it, it's not going to work. But you know what I'm saying,
right? Right. You can at least extend your growing season.
That's right. That's right. And if you're clever, there are ways that you can protect your growing your mini greenhouses and stuff like that from snowfall and excessive rain by putting a slide sheet over it that you build with some clothesline and a couple poles, and you can pull it over and shield those things from intrusion by, you know, the environment or the weather. But anyway, that's not a major issue, because if you grow tomatoes and you grow, let's say, we've got 15 trees in our fruit orchard too. We grow fruit and we can it. We make preserves, we make jelly, and you can stew tomatoes and things like that and put them over. We have like peppers that we preserve peppers. You can do that in vinegar and various other things. You can grow pickles, you know, just cucumbers. You can grow the garden type cucumbers and the long ones for your salad, or you can grow the short stubby ones with little warts all over it, which are pickles. And these just grow really well in these things. We grow squash. We grow, acorn squash. We grow cilantro, a spice we use in our Mexican cooking here, or Tex-Mex. We grow Jerusalem artichoke, which is a tubular. It grows down in the ground underneath. And we've got a 4x8 for that one, because the root of that, you harvest it in the fall, and it lasts you for a year, all that stuff. It helps to cure diabetes and to hold it back. You eat about the size of a big fat hen egg once or twice a week, and it keeps your blood sugar in control.
Well, speaking of hens, what do you do for protein?
Well, our neighbors, one of them has chickens, and we're going to trade with him for a while, but we are thinking about putting in chickens here. But the problem you've got there is you've got to feed them, and you know you're not going to run down the store and get chicken food or your chicken feed for them. So it's going to be table scraps. If you got any left, they'll be sharing on part of the stuff that you eat to give you the protein. And to that end, you can buy freeze-dried vegetables and things that are on trays and do it that way. Pluck them up. So I'd say we've looked at it, and the cost of building the hen house and protecting it is holding us back. So we're going to trade with neighbors and friends that have got eggs. We'll trade them, you know, that kind of stuff. It's a barter system, and that's the way we're going to handle it. But certainly, the chickens would be good. And if you are going to breed them and have, you know, roosters come out of it, you're going to have to watch your rooster, because he'll wake up everybody in the neighborhood and you won't be popular. And it also tells the predators where your chicken coop is.
Right, right.
So in essence, you have a bunch of females, you know, a bunch of hens who are laying. And they will lay year-round if you get the right kind, and in quite plentifully, but you still have to feed them and give them water.
What about fish farming?
Fish farming is good. We tried that on our farm down in Australia, and we had about 100,000 gallon pond there. And we raised yellow tails and silver tails, I think, something like that they call them down there, but that takes probably a year, year and a half to get them up to eating size.
All right, listen, we'll take another time out. We'll come back. We'll have about 15 minutes to get people prepared. We can do that, right? 15 minutes? Stan Deo is with us, standeo.com. His wife Holly's book is Dare to Prepare, and he's also the author of The Cosmic Conspiracy. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Here's another age-old skill that has gone by the boards years ago that's going to come in handy again, and that's candle making. Do you know how to make your own candles, Stan?
Yep, that's in Holly's book, too.
Is that fairly straightforward?
Oh, it is. You just need to have your supplies, you know, your wax and your tallow or whatever you're going to use, and some thread to use, you know, or like a little thicker than thread, some cord to use as a wick. But she goes through all that in the book. It's a very comprehensive thing that she's put together over the years, as people would write and say, because we've been doing this for, like, gosh, 16, 17 years. And she started a community newsletter when we were down in Australia. And people would say, listen, how do you do such and such? She said, well, I'll check and see, you know. And she'd write out on the Internet, and people would write in. But let me give you an idea of what's in this book just by chapters. I mean, there's a chapter, a whole chapter dedicated to type of generators and what you need. And, you know, if you're going to do emergency water treatment, there's two or three chapters on that. How you can find water like the Aborigines do, we've tried that, and there's a very clever way to do that. And you just need some artificial grass for that in a little elevated place, and you can make the sun give you fresh water out of salt water or all kinds of junk water. First aid supplies you need, she discusses that, underground storage, colloidal silver, soap making, candle making, fire building, you know, how to do it like, the, you know, from scratch. Just common things, and how you make biodiesel fuel. Composting is another thing that you need that to put in your dirt for the next season. And then how to grow food, there's a whole chapter on that as well, how to dry jerky and vegetables and things if you've got, you know, protein as well.
And seed, seed storage and collection is important. I mean, you've got to hold back, obviously, some of the seeds for the next growing season, and then how do you store those seeds?
Well, now, you don't want it to... let them be in a temperature that's, say, above 70 degrees. You want to keep them at a constant temperature at 70 between, say, you can take them out of freezing. We've got some we keep in our freezers, but when the electricity goes, we'll have to be letting them go at a cool temperature, which you can dig down, like the old root cellars they used to have. You dig it down probably 6 to 10 feet, well, 6 to 8 feet, I guess, and down that deep, you can cover it over and keep the temperature fairly stable, and the seeds will stay for viable for 2 or 3 years from one season, as long as you don't buy hybrid plants to start with, because those seeds aren't any good. They come off of that. They'll give you a spindly fruit or vegetables if they give you anything at all. She also covers how to take care of your pets, provide for them with some of the food and stuff that you're going to be eating and that they would need. Gas masks, nuclear emergencies, how to survive the fallout cloud, you know. There's a heap of stuff in there. And you can read about it on the website. You can go click on that, standale.com, and click on Dare to Prepare, and she'll show you the chapter titles and give you an idea of what's in that book. I mean, her book is being used by government first responder classes, okay? It is really the Bible of emergency preparedness for homes and even for, like, the counties and cities and stuff, and small cities and things.
Give us some tips on some ordinary household items that can be used for other purposes. I remember reading once about a makeup mirror could be used to start a fire, or a watch could be turned into a compass. These sorts of things.
Oh, a camera lens. If you got a camera, you can. I have a little thing that I bought at Amazon, which fits in my pocket because I'm getting older and I need to, enlarge the menu so I can read it at a restaurant. And it's got a little thing about the size. It's less than the size of a quarter. It's probably about a nickel size. A little magnifying glass built into it, not thick. And I started to fire out in the orchard yesterday with it to some of the dead leaves. I just thought, I'll try this and see. It took me something like 5 seconds. And those you can carry around with you. You can start fires that way. And you got to know a little bit about how to get your tinder and, you know, the stuff to trigger the fire. One thing I wanted to address here before we go into some of these other common things is on that show images page, I did some research on a couple of very important issues. One, people were saying, look, can we protect our devices inside of a metal trash can that you can get at the hardware store?
Use it as a Faraday cage, essentially.
You can, but I've got a video on there. It's down around the fourth line down the first image there. It goes to a video on YouTube where Dr. Arthur Bradley, who wrote a book on the subject, actually does the proper thing in testing broadcast signals and shielding in a trash can. And he shows you that if you just put that metal lid on that trash can, it's not going to be very efficient at all. It will let the EMP leak in. It's such strength that it will hurt the device and kill it, you know, whatever you're storing in there. But he says if you go down to Lowe's and you buy 2-inch wide, you know, the air conditioning ducting tape, that metal conductive tape.
Right, right.
And you just put that around. It's sticky and it's conductive. You just tape around the edge of that lid where it joins the can, and it increases by about 500% the shielding. And it's not expensive.
There you go. So your metal trash can be used as an EMP cage. Now, someone else just emailed me. Actually, it's our friend The Dude, one of our listeners. The Dude, he goes by. And he says everyone's got a Faraday cage practically in their house. Their microwave oven. You just unplug it. Well, in the event of a power outage, it's going to be useless anyway. So
right.
You could store things in your old microwave oven.
You could indeed. Now, there's something else, too. Now, a lot of people are you know, getting these trash can type things to do it. They need to know about that foil that, or that tape you put around it. But also, you need to put something inside there that's non-conductive, like a plastic or not newspaper or cardboard that can get, if it gets any water in it, it'll conduct. So you want something like plastic or wood, hard wood, to sit whatever you're protecting on top of, so it doesn't touch the edge of the can on the inside. And secondly, there have been a lot of tests done out at the White Sands nuclear facility, testing what an EMP will do to your car. And they have a big tunnel that you can, that they've been driving cars through and hitting it with a field strength of an EMP bomb. And contrary to what a lot of people think, 97% of the cars out there will survive it. It might make your clock run a bit funny, but the car, if it stops, it'll glide to a stop. It won't just suddenly jerk to a stop, and you can restart it.
Ah, well, that's some good news.
It is. Now, if you take a wire and attach it to the frame of your car and put it down into a pipe you drive down the ground about 4 or 5 feet, you know, a copper rod or something like that, so you ground it, you can then use your car as a Faraday cage. Throw stuff in it, shut the door, and it's safe. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So, you know, it's not the best, but it'll do in a pinch. You can use Mylar bags. We talk about that, you know, here a lot, because Holly uses it in the Dare to Prepare and in the food storage section. A Mylar bag is like those shiny balloons that you get at Walmart or something, you know, helium balloon. But a bag made out of that stuff is much higher quality, and you can take that and put your cell phone in, you put other things in, roll it up, put a clamp on it, and it shields. I've got a video on that there, too, on using that. So those are important things about this Faraday cage, because I wanted to get people to read it and be educated. And there's a report by the government, the report of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse Attack. That report is on my website. It's a PDF. Click on it. It's down the fourth row right in the middle in blue and white lettering. Click on that and read that sucker, and you will be amazed at what you see. I mean, they don't just talk about devices and stuff. They talk about damages to transportation, what will happen to pacemakers. You know, again, about 90% of the pacemakers, you'll get through it because they've been building them now with metal shielding on them so that when they put the paddles on somebody to revive them, it doesn't hit their pacemaker. So pacemakers will probably be okay for most people.
You know, that hadn't even occurred to me in the event of an EMP. What will happen to all these people with pacemakers?
And not only that, the ones that do fail, and that'll be a very small percent, the body is not going to, I mean, the heart's not going to stop unless something really, you know, like panic sets in, because the heart will normally be producing a weak firing pulse for the, you know, to make it convulse, and that will pick up, and it will be erratic and stuff like that, but you'll still be alive. So you don't panic, you know. I mean, even if your pacemaker fails, so you just go on to Plan B, where you're not quite as active and you're careful and keep calm. But there's just so many good things like that in this report. Not everything from the government is bad news.
No, absolutely not. No. Give us a couple of other items, useful household items that are handy in an emergency.
Okay. Power is, if you can get power. Solar panels and power batteries, I suggest that you get Edison and nickel iron batteries. You can get them from, in Denver, there's a young fellow that's been bringing them from China, but he's going to start making them pretty soon in his company. But, you know, wind generators, solar generators, bicycles that be turned into, you know, like you put out maybe, 80 to 100 joules, you know, like watts, if you're pedaling pretty fast. But anyway, these kind of things you can get from a company called IronEdison.com, IronEdison.com. And this concept was invented by Mr. Edison 100 and some odd years ago, Thomas Edison, and they still work, and they're better than the other batteries as far as how much power you can get out of them. A friend of mine and I are working on a prototype of a way to make a wind generator that has no moving parts. The wind will blow through it and build up a charge in a capacitor, and you can then dump that into these batteries and use it. So power, water, food, biological necessities, medicines. Get ahead on your medicines. If your own painkillers or things that you can stretch out a bit, then stretch them out and get a month or two ahead, you know, by cutting back a bit, but storing them in a cool place. Let's see.
What else would you put in an emergency first aid kit?
Oh, well, there's for severe wounds and things like that, you can get these blood clotter packs that you just put onto a wound and tie it on, and it will cause it to clot very quickly so that you don't bleed to death. Tourniquets are nice. Things to get eye swabs and things like that, and eye rinses for antihistamine, you know, like for bee stings and also for, you know, things that might get in a person's eye, little tweezers that are, you know.
A good pair of tweezers is absolutely essential, yeah.
Yeah, Band-Aids, you know, small Band-Aids, and then you got the gauze Band-Aid, you got the gauze pads, and you got the tape to wrap around. You can get that special kind of tape that's kind of stretchy. And you can, I'm sure you've seen it when you get your blood taken, they put them on those.
Yeah, a woman's sanitary napkin, great for first aid.
Yeah, and I've heard some reports, if you get a sanitary napkin, it's like a rod, you know, like a...
Right.
You can plug that in a wound for temporary, you know, stopping the bleeding. But, okay, and let's see, what else have we got in there? We've got those, we've got that.
I think that, you know, we're just about out of time here, Stan, but I think the other thing, and you talked about this as well, is get to know your neighbors, and you've got to form these communities because, let's face it, most of us are not going to perform self-dentistry. Most of us are not going to be able to perform surgery. So, you know, you've got to get to know your neighbors, and hopefully you're going to be in an area where there is a doctor.
My neighbors is a dentist.
There you go.
Very important.
Yeah, so we can't do this on our own. We've got to form little communities.
Yeah, I know. I joke, but we are at the time right now where you've got a little bit of time, a few days, weeks, whatever, before everything falls apart. I'd say mid to late summer, we're going to see things hitting the United States that aren't going to be pleasant. But get started now. And Holly tells you, look, it doesn't matter whether you only prepare for one day. You're better off than you were the day before.
That's right. Well, listen, Stan, again, we'll direct people to the website standeo.com, Stan, S-T-A-N, Deo, D-E-Y-O.com. And the book written by your lovely bride, Holly, Dare to Prepare. Lots of information in there. Can they order the book right off the website?
They can. We've had a recent increase in demand, and so we're in reprint now that I've put up on the website. We'll have new stock in the 16th of this month, but they've just swamped us here. So,
all right. Stan, great pleasure. We'll do it again sometime soon.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Stan Deo. My thanks to Tim Spreen. Back next week, brand new program. Hope you'll be along for the ride. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What I say in the dark, speak in the light. What you hear in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.